now contracts with the Pacifica Network to bring you the program, and we bring it to you here at WPFW. We don't record it and play it later. We play it just as it's coming out of the Green Studio in Chelsea, New York. 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org. We are still in need of $980, and we ask you to go to the phones now. Ethelbert Miller is coming up. E. Ethelbert Miller is coming up in just a moment with On the Margin. You are in tune to WPFW Washington.
On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is James Early. James Early is a former Assistant Secretary for Education and Public Service at the Smithsonian Folklife Center. While at the Smithsonian, he was also the Director of Cultural Heritage Policy Center for Folklore, Life, and Cultural Heritage. James Early is a former Interim Director of the Anacostia Museum. How are you doing this morning, James?
I'm doing good, brother. Good to be with you.
Okay. You know, we're in the middle of a fundraising drive, and people will be calling 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. James, on July 16, 2024, the scholar, singer, composer, and activist Dr. Bernice Johnson Regan died. She was a founding member of the SNCC Freedom Singers, a founder of the singing group Sweet Honey in the Rock. Dr. Regan created the program in Black American Culture at the Smithsonian Institution. During her lifetime, she received the MacArthur Foundation Genius Award, as well as the President Medal for the contribution to public understanding of the humanities. James, what I want to do begin our program is by reading an excerpt from James Forman, The Making of Black Revolutionaries. And I think this is still one of the best books written about the civil rights movement. Forman served as Executive Secretary of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee from 1961 to 1966. And this is what he writes about Bernice. Your understanding of the historical process of liberation keeps you singing. You have been able to forge new words to meet changing conditions. You have grown with the demands of the struggle. Your life is forever unfolding as the lives of your people unfold and move down the path of liberation. Your songs today of Africa fit the transition in which we find ourselves. From the dusty roads of Albany, Georgia, through the cities of the United States, from many years ago and for many years to come, the music you make is only a reflection of your total understanding. Through the years, your love for humanity and hatred of oppression will keep you singing. Comment on that, James Early.
Well, one, I think you're correct that this is one of the most important books on the civil rights movement. And I think it's one of the most important documentations, firsthand documentations about the role and presence and singularity in terms of the contributions of Bernice Johnson Regan. He, just to quote him again, and when the call came to protest the killings, you were up front. You led the line. Your feet hit the dirt pavement with a sureness of direction. You walked proudly on with singing, "This Little Light of Mine," and the people echoed, "Shine, shine, shine." It illustrates how grounded Bernice was in community. Forman also notes that prior to the Albany movement, the freedom songs had not been a consistent part of, quote unquote, the resistance struggle. But it was, as he says, the unforgettable voice of Bernice Johnson Regan leading the way herself, led by the awakened spirit of an awakened people. So I think we need to look at Bernice as a social construct that had a high individual profile. And I think Forman captures that. And I would refer people to look at that book, because it also indicates that Bernice was always grounded in a consciousness and a documentation about the community in which she grew up, the community in which she was embedded. And so her scholarship, if you will, her research and documentation really predates her formal education, both at Albany State at 16, where she ended Albany State, and her PhD work at Howard University starting in 1971.
Let me ask you a large question. How important are songs and music when we discuss social movements?
Fundamentally important, because, and Bernice is an exemplar of that, as are many others, but songs reflect the sensibility, the ways of knowing and doing, the emotional character of grassroots communities when we talk about folk songs or community-based culture. They are historical reflections of the ways of knowing and doing that's characteristic of a community. And in that context, then we have highly individualized expressions, as we saw in the case of Bernice.
You know, one of the things I was reading that Bernice Regan was responsible for doing, at least she talks about doing it, and that is singing and changing the ear in a space.
Yes. You know, Bernice had a saying that Dr. Amy Horowitz likes to recite, that if something is missing, it's probably the sound of your own voice. And so agency, self-agency, self-reflection in relationship to others was something that Bernice was very much about. And so that song and hearing are, you know, two basic sensory elements of human society. She raised a fundamental level of making sense and acting on that common sense, if you will, coming out of community.
You know, with what our listeners might want to look at, Bernice Regan had a very long essay, Let Your Light Shine, Historical Notes, which is in the book, We Who Believe in Freedom, Sweet Honey the Rock, Still on the Journey, which is an excellent analysis in terms of interpretation of what she's doing. And one of the things that she says in that essay, James, I want you to comment on, she talks about having a conversation with the audience, that when Sweet Honey the Rock is singing, it's a conversation.
Well, I think absolutely right. In the first instance, you know, the founding of Sweet Honey as she used to like to say very directly, a community-based organization, coming out of the Last Colony Theater, where she was asked to come and deal with voice training for the actors. And if you think about Sweet Honey and The Rock, each of those individual women have highly individualized voices. And so while Bernice was the founder convener, each had their own voice. Dr. Isai Barnes-Well, you know, comes to mind, a scholar in her own right, Carol Maylard, among Louise Robinson, others, who had their own voice. In Process was a larger group that still exists here in Washington, sort of like a sewing circle of women coming together to give voice of their own individual being, not necessarily to go on stage, although In Process still is the foundational community-based element out of which Sweet Honey and The Rock and many women came through that process. So this really captures, again, the social context of Bernice Regan and then her singular profile in that context.
Well, let's talk about the Youngs Chambers early. to take you back to 1967, you meet Bernice Regan down in Atlanta. Talk about that meet, and how did you see when you first met her? And then was she talking about, you know, things that had happened at Albany State?
Well, when I first visually saw her, I'd be on the corner with Wine Drinkers at Morehouse, and
probably with Ripple or yes, something yes, like
we,
that.
We were doing community based research, if you will. We would see her leaving Spelman College, striding across Morehouse's campus down. No,
wait a minute. Let me interrupt you. Is that like Morehouse men looking at the Spelman women?
Well, in a manner of speaking, we were, and there would be the whispers. You see that woman? You know, she's been in jail. She was already a resonant presence, a resonant figure in the minds of many young people who didn't really grasp the full sense either of the civil rights movement of who she was, but we knew that she was distinguished. And she would be headed to the edge of Morehouse's campus, where she lived in a house with her two children, Toshi Regan, now the renowned composer, songwriter, and her son, Kwame Regan, who's out in California, with a joint stairwell connected downstairs where Dr. Vincent Harding, who was head of the sociology department at Spelman, and his wife and two children live. And so when I saw her physically, I could feel the power, because I come from early part of my life, a rural background in Florida. I knew that she was sort of the earth of community, if you will. Later, I came to know her around 1967. I really began to engage her, or really she began to engage me. Bernice always looked around of who was in her community, and when she needed something done or needed to know something, she drew on the immediate people and gave them tasks and assignments. And I was one of those people, fortunate enough to be tasked. And so then I realized that she was more than a singer, more than a civil rights activist. She always described herself as a freedom singer. But she was already doing historical research with Dr. Stephen Henderson, whose book you, along with two other editors, are coming out on his life. Mm-hmm. Stephen Henderson was head of the English department at Morehouse. And she and Stephen Henderson started to do something called a folklife festival of traditional blues singers, mm-hmm. and culinary mm-hmm. traditions and the like.
Well, let me take you back to something, James, because you're talking about Bernice, but I want to also talk about you. Did Bernice pull out, you know, she's the activist in James Early, you know, you're hanging out on the corner drinking the wine and stuff. Did she see something in you and say, brother, follow me, get more involved politically?
That was not the narrative, but that's a good summary. Me, as well as many others that she drew in, she called me one day when I was working at the Martin Luther King Documentation Project. Vincent Harding heard I needed a job after I had been, my degree had been suspended from Morehouse for taking over the administration building. Where Bernice, hearing that on radio, the taking over the administration building, she was out in the community. She came up to the administration building, came in, and made her contribution in the hallway singing a song called The Black Musician, Magician. Later, she called me when I was at the MLK Center where her sister was working. We were working in the archives on SNCC papers, and asked if I had access to a tape recorder, if I knew how to use it. She wanted me to come and tape a Black Songwriters Conference. And I was really struck, you know, why me? So she also introduced me to the Smithsonian, and she's the one who really made sure that I was hired there to do research. We were fellow graduate students, Ford Foundation PhD fellows at Howard. We came to Washington in 1971. And she also insisted that I become the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Education and Public Service, along with Ralph Rensselaer, whom she had long collaborated, you know, starting back prior to 1970. But in 1970, Ralph asked her to come and curate a program at
the... Okay, I'm going to stop you right there. I want to take you back, okay? I'm going to go back, okay? In your youth. But I want to go back. Bernice was the daughter of Reverend Jesse Johnson, a Baptist minister. Would it be accurate to say that without the Black church, we may not have a Bernice Reagan?
I think that would be fundamentally accurate, because it was out of the Black church and where she developed her ways of analyzing her life and the community life and the national life and the global life that she was stepping into. And she framed that very explicitly about a congregational methodology.
Mm-hmm. Let me make a connection here and see this. I'm thinking here aloud. I'm looking at this coming out of the church. This is the 100th anniversary of James Baldwin's birth. Okay, Baldwin comes out of the church. And if you hear him singing, you know, Precious Lord, you know that Baldwin comes out of the church. Right. But Baldwin comes out of a church in Harlem. What does it mean for Bernice Johnson Reagan to come out of a rural church, a church that has no piano?
Well, you're talking about the Black Belt South, where the largest concentration of Black people and the super exploitation of their labor in the cotton and tobacco fields and the like came out. This is where Black people were grounded with many continuations of African ways of knowing and doing. And in that church where there was no piano in Mount Early Baptist Church, which was about 80 miles from where I was growing up in Tallahassee.
That's not named after you either, right?
No, it's not named after an avowed atheist, but it always resonates when I'm thinking about her and when I see that and the relationship that she and I developed over the years. So coming out of the Black Belt South, coming out of those rural communities where the terrorism of American apartheid, the brutality, the undermining of our humanity, the rape of our women. She was thrown out of Albany State because she challenged white men trying to come and pick up young Black women students there. That is quite different from going up in Harlem And so, yes, the Black Belt South and like grounded community, and where song was something that bonded and everybody had a voice. This is the congregational methodology that she talks about. And there was no piano. And so it was the foot and the hand that gave the rhythm. And she has documented this in her own voice. I should say here that for the last 5 years, we've been trying to get the Smithsonian Institution to look at Bernice Reagan as a scholar unsuccessfully, which is a reflection that many legacy institutions fail to deal with their own legacies. But we are hopeful that someone will explore her as a scholar, because we see her as a someone in voice and her song. You know, she was also a playwright who wrote about Washington, D.C., a day of life of people, about Anacostia and ordinary, everyday, community-based people.
Well, you know, we're here at the radio station. We're not in church, but we can bring in one of those little angels, Katia Stick, to join us. Katia, are you there?
Wow, what an introduction. I am here.
We know you have little wings hidden.
Well, good morning, gentlemen. This is a really fascinating discussion about Dr. Bernice Johnson Reagan, and I'm learning things, James, that I did not know. I did not know she was a playwright, for instance. That is the first time I've heard that. And this is the kind of conversation, the kind of connection that E. Ethelbert Miller brings us every Thursday on the margin. And if you are appreciating this conversation like I am, and like many, many, not only across the region, but also around the world, because we are streaming. If you're appreciating this conversation right now and appreciate what Ethelbert brings to the air and what On the Margin is, then give us a call. Pledge your support, 800-222-9739. We have a $500 goal this hour, and we can do that. You can consider becoming a sustaining member if that works better for your budget. That's where you have $10, $20, $50, $100 a month, and you can stop that draft anytime from your bank account if you like. But we hope that you would at least consider a year of that. You can also use Cash App, $WPFWFM, to pledge your support to On the Margin. However you choose to connect with us this morning, help Ethelbert meet his goal. I won't be able to honestly look at him if we don't do that. So he will hold it against me. So please help
take away your wings.
Exactly. Exactly. You heard it first. So 800-222-9739 or WPFWFM.org. We are joking, but supporting On the Margin, supporting WPFW is no laughing matter. It is critical to our cultural and political understandings of the world. Ethelbert?
Yeah, I'm having a devil of a good time this morning.
Oh, boy.
James, you mentioned, as we talk about Bernice Reagan, you talked about Vincent Harding. And I also want to talk about not just Vincent Harding, but also Rose Harding. And then I want you to also talk about two other people, actually maybe three other people that had an influence on Bernice. And that's Pete Seeger and his wife, Toshi. And then also Ella Baker, who was I think Bernice would call her, that would be Bernice's political mother. Ella Baker was the first executive secretary of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and she died in 1986. But talk about those individuals, you know, not just Vincent Harding, but Rose Harding, and also not just Pete Seeger, but Toshi Seeger, and then Ella Baker.
So Black women are central to the identity of Bernice, both as an individual being a woman, but also in terms of the Black community, the role of Black women in the church, notwithstanding the fact that her father was a minister of the church. It is, and she documents this in her own words, drawing on the history of the participation and the voice and the contributions of Black women. You know, I don't know how my mother walked her troubles down. I don't know how my father stood his ground, standing in a rainstorm, I do believe, which is one of the documentary elements. Rose Harding, who we need to talk about much, much more, she and Vincent Harding had been invited by Dr. Martin Luther King down to deal with the interracial groupings who were trying to break American apartheid. And so Rose and Vincent were of strong religious grounding. Vincent was a Black Mennonite, and they had a strong faith, but an action-oriented faith. And so Bernice being in that household as a colleague, she was a student and a colleague. This is the thing that these great scholars always recognize, that here was an organic intellectual, my terminology, if you will, and they collaborated with her, not just teaching her. So both Vincent and Stephen Henderson and Rose Harding, the founding of the Harambe Singers, which predates Fidani and the Rock, a Black woman's organization, developed to fund the first interracial preschool in Atlanta. Again, women with individualized voices coming into the public space, not as entertainment, but as education. So women were very solidly there. Let me just skip quickly to say that the first Martin Luther King lecture that Ralph Rinzler and I did at the Smithsonian, the first lecture was Sweet Honey and the Rock. People were saying, oh, this is a concert. I said, you miss the historical research and the ancestral voices that are brought by these contemporary individualized singers. And that was all the grounding of Bernice. And so this Vincent Harding played a key role. She was one of the founding members of the Institute of the Black World, co-founded, really co-conceptualized by Vincent Harding and Stephen Henderson. There were others there, but they were the two principals that initiated that project. And so Bernice was there. Vincent sent us both to the Ford Foundation. That's how we ended up working on PhD. She getting hers, my dropping out.
And talk about Pete Seeger and Toshi Seeger.
So Pete Seeger, it is documented, suggested that the Freedom Singers really become organized. I think this was a gathering at Morehouse College where he heard them and suggested that they be a propagation voice of the civil rights movement moving around the country. And it was Toshi Seeger, Pete's wife and activist partner, who organized a lot of the major venues in New York City, and who had a powerful influence in facilitation and collaboration with Bernice, such that Bernice's first child, the now renowned composer, songwriter, Toshi Regan, is named after Toshi Seeger, Pete Seeger's wife. And there are these iconic photographs of, you know, Pete Seeger listening to and singing with Bernice. And it opened up a broader progressive and radical context in which I remember her saying to me once, she was singing in New York, and afterwards she was at this party and she asked to use the telephone, and she went back and she called James Twerman and she said, they're communists in this gathering. So, you know, of course, Pete Seeger always saw himself as a communist in a very popular way. If clean water was about communism, I'm a communist, he would say. But that opened up larger intersection, or reflected a larger intersection, between the radical activism and agency of the Black Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee moving into the larger, not just national world, but as Karen Spellman has noted in a recent article in the City Paper, Bernice's Pan-Africanist outlook.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk about Ella Baker. We have Ella's song. And I think of also not just Ella Baker, but I'm looking at Fannie Lou Hamer as a singer. You know, I mean, these, and then also another singer, Odetta. You know,
Odetta. Well, Bernice is in that tradition. Consciously, she inserted her voice, her particular tone and sound and outlook in that historical context. She was very much about being a carrier of legacy. And she was very clear that these were models and motivating individuals in the development, not just of her aesthetic voice, her sound, but her thinking about the world and her positioning herself in the social, political context of the world. You know, Bernice, this saying that has just come out recently that Toshi, her daughter, I don't know where it's written down or if just this is from Toshi's memory, but Bernice saying, I was here before I came.
Right.
And when I die, I'm not leaving. I was here before I came. What is that telling us? That there were people before me that have brought me here, that I am really an echo.
And you know what it sounds like, though? It also sounds like it's a quote, but it says Sun Ra. Sun Ra says, Sun Ra left. and someone came back only to tell people that he left.
Right.
You know.
Well, Bernice had a deep, you know, there's a deep meta dimension of Bernice, because in the Journal of American Folk Life article that Dr. Amy Horowitz and I authored in honor of commemoration of Bernice's 80th birthday, there is this phrasing where she talks about being a medium, of bringing the voices of the ancestors. So she was a serious historian, but she understood that there was a level of communication with the past. And of course, the women that you name, while they were still alive, they preceded her, but she was connected to them and an extension of them, and they were connected to many voices that we don't know before Ella Baker, Annie Luther, that I think they understood who they were connected to.
You know, when you talk about all these connections, I think of another name that I know was down there at Spelman, and I was wondering if he had an influence on Bernice, and that's Howard Zinn.
Howard Zinn was teaching at Spelman, and he was there when I was a freshman. He came before I was a freshman at Morehouse in 1965. And while I can't speak to the particulars of the relationship between Bernice and Howard Zinn, clearly his engagement with the civil rights movement and the worldview that he had, there was some synergy there. But I don't know the particular intersection between the two of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I want to move up. You know, we've been talking, going back and forth. I always am interested. You said that you came up to Washington, D.C. and Howard University. You guys had a little Ford Foundation. Some people said you guys were run out of Atlanta.
Well, no, Vincent Harding. Vincent, I never really directly talked to Bernice about this, but it was Vincent who called me in one day and who said, Jim, he always called me Jim, I think you should go to graduate school. It's not something I had considered, and I want you to go talk to these people. As he had contacted me earlier when he knew that I had a job, I needed a job. I was down and out. And he had brought me to the Martin Luther King Documentation Project. And then sometimes within that year, he called me and said, go down and talk to the Southern Education Foundation, Eldridge McMillan, an African-American who runs that foundation. And they gave me a fellowship. Bernice also had one, which paid my way for Vincent to bring me up to the Institute of the Black World. So Vincent Harding is a grounding element of the development of Bernice, and also had a major influence on my life, although the two of them were much closer than he and I were. But he was a major force in opening up a vision of where we might go and what we might do.
You know, I draw a straight line from Vincent Harding to Andrew Billingsley, because when you're coming up to Howard University, we're now dealing with actually the impact of this Howard University student movement, because we see the removal of President James Neighbor and the hiring of James Cheek. And one of the things that Cheek does is hire Andrew Billingsley as the Vice President of Academic Affairs, and Billingsley creates the Institute for Arts and Humanities. Okay, that becomes a very important organization, not just for the National Writers' Conferences, but also for the National Folklore Conferences that was held. And I believe that Henderson might have invited Sweet Honey the Rock to come and perform at one of the beginning of that. But I want to ask you these questions. In what way is Bernice Reagan a groundbreaking contributor in the fields of folklore studies?
Bernice had started doing work as early as probably earlier than I know, but 67 and 68, she was doing the Soul Roots festivals with Stephen Henderson at Morehouse in the Atlanta University Center and Spelman. With Anne Romaine in 1966, they started the Southern Folklore Cultural Revival Project, the first interracial folk festivals in the South. Anne Romaine was a very important figure that continued that work for about 25 years. She was out of Appalachia. So Bernice was always researching. She was always observing her environment. It was Roland Freeman, the late Roland Freeman, the African-American photo documentarian of community-based culture, that suggested the organization of the African and African-American folklorists. That's where the idea came from. He said to me, why do Black people not go to the major American Folklore Association meeting, which was not totally true. And so he says he was meeting with Stephen Henderson in a week or so, and I said, why don't you bring it up? So that's where it started. So then Steve Henderson said to me, Steve was my head of the English department when I was at Morehouse. And then, of course, I was around the Institute of Black World, and we are both Florida homeboys. And I spent a lot of time as an undergraduate talking with Steve. I wish I remember all of the things. It was not so much academic and intellectual, but certainly intellectual, but more social and political. Steve said, Jim, he always called me Jim, we need to have a cultural statement here. And I said, oh, Steve, by the way, Miriam and I were just invited by Bernice to come and see a rehearsal of the workshop group at the Last Colony Theater, Sweet Honey in the Rock. So in the book, We Who Believe in Freedom, which Bernice edited.
Let me correct that. You said the Last Colony. Is that like the D.C. Black Repertory Company?
The D.C. Repertory, the theater, I'm saying.
Okay.
Which
is, all right. Okay.
I don't know why I'm the Last Colony. It's an apartment complex now called the Last Colony. But in any event, so I mentioned to Steve, and then Steve extended a paid invitation. So they know it was their first paid gig. But Roland Freeman is the key. And of course, Bernice spoke there. So did Leon Contron Damas, who was one of the three major one of the three major figures of Negritude, along with Senghor and Amy Zazier. And of course, he was one of our colleagues. We were youngsters. He was here at Howard University, and Steve was there. And so
there's one name that just seems to be missing. You made a lot of names, but let me, I'm glad you mentioned Roland. Worth Long.
Wow, Worth Long, who is an institution unto himself, who's still living. He and Roland Freeman were the closest of colleagues. He did groundbreaking work on African-American community-based culture, folk community culture, ordinary everyday people and the power of their imaginations, their visions, their creativity, their modes of communication, their sense of aesthetics, their common sense, if you will. And so Worth Long, along with Roland and Bernice, are a trio that needs to be studied in the synergy. And so that when Gerald Davis, the late Gerald Davis, who was a graduate student at Rutgers University, also then an associate director of the Festival of American Folklife, came up with the concept of the African diaspora, which Bernice then became the major curator of. Bernice brought in Worth Long, who was, you know, helped to ground that. And you know, people should look at his work, and particularly students who want to look at agency in African-American life from community, from the vantage point of ordinary people. Okay. Worth Long is a very important figure in his own right.
Okay, James Early, you're an important figure also. Okay, we'll take a little break here. My guest this morning is James Early, and I introduce him as being the former interim director of the Anacostia Museum and many other things. But the station is WPFW, and we're in the middle of a fundraising drive. And Katia, do you want to join us at this little interval?
I would love to, Ethelbert. We are still in need of $500 this hour, 800-222-9739. Although I do understand the conversation is so interesting that it's hard to break away and make that pledge of support. But we ask you right now to support that which supports you. Ethelbert's program does that every week on the margin. 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org. What can be more wonderful than supporting him on a day where we're talking about Dr. Bernice, the beloved Dr. Bernice Johnson Reagan, and really delving into her life and her not only the things that influenced her, but her influences on others. There are so many who were touched by her, and I'm sure this is a conversation where you're learning a lot. And it's really fascinating. So make that call that makes the difference. You make everything here at WPFW possible. We love the fact that Ethelbert comes to us every Thursday morning at 9 a.m. And so do you. So please make a contribution during our summer membership drive, 800-222-9739 or WPFWFM.org.
Okay. Thank you, Katia. Many people know I don't know how to drive, but Katia, I don't know who's pledging because I can't see the
That's okay. I'm going to keep you up to date. I promise. That's what you had me for.
Okay. All right. That's why. That's why you're at the wheel. Okay.
And so, Ethelbert, permit me to say to the audience, listen, you can multitask. You can listen to this program and pledge at the same time. This is a very important public space, not just for your listening pleasure, but for your voicing. We're talking about a woman who talked about voice, that everybody has a voice, and it's the sound of your own voice. So make it known by supporting this program. And if you happen to miss something, it will be recorded. So please support the station.
Okay. James, there's something I want to ask you about that you're making reference to Amy Horowitz. You guys produced a good overview of Bernice's work in the winter 2023 issue of the Journal of American Folklore. Did you have to lobby to get that essay into the American Journal of American Folklore? And how important is that to be for Bernice to have that presence in that type of publication?
No, we did not really have to lobby. The editor-in-chief, Lisa Gilman, who was at the folklore program at George Mason University, readily accepted the invitation. We would not have been able to finish this project without her continued facilitation and support and editorial advice. And so Amy Horowitz is who probably has followed Bernice's work in various dimensions, more so than anyone that I'm aware of, is the one who got me involved in the project. And she led the project, although by way of a convention of American publications, my name comes first because it's E before H. It's really should be H before E. It's Amy Horowitz who really set this up. And so we didn't have any problem doing that. We wanted to do this project to really stimulate the interest of a new generation of students and scholars to study Bernice's work as a scholar, because we think that's an underlooked element of, and it's a fulcrum. She was always a scholar even before she had these degrees. She was always researching, documenting, comparing, and out of that, her individual voice and creativity was informed. And so that's how this came to pass. We did not try to do a definitive view. We're just trying to stimulate this. We were also very cognizant of that we are extremely close to the presence of Bernice Reagan, and we didn't want to do a hey, we wanted to avoid a hagiographic kind of piece. And so we didn't try to do a definitive view. This is an invitation for people to do that research.
Talk more about Amy Horowitz, who, and also talk about her work with the Smithsonian Folkways recordings. And then also mention the importance of Barbara Dane.
So, Amy Horowitz, who's former interim or acting interim acting director, I can't remember the qualifying title of Folkways Records, Issue Give Your Hands to Freedom, was worked with Bernice. They're the founders of Sister Fire and Road Work, at a time when women's music, particularly gay women, not exclusively gay women, but specifically gay women, voices were not in the public space. And Bernice and Amy opened that institutional element up. Ralph Rinzler, who was co-founder of the Festival of American Folklife and the assistant secretary, later assistant secretary for education and public service, where he invited me to come as his deputy, was key in also helping to develop the Roadwork project. And that album that Amy reissued is critically important. Barbara Dane, who was the first freedom singer to go after the Cuban Revolution, who is now 96, is a film documentary out on her life, and her autobiography is out, was the key founder of Paradigm Records. And her husband, the late Irwin Sober, who had written on labor songs, and who Paul Robeson and Bob Dylan and Pete Seeger, not Bob Dylan, Pete Seeger, had asked to found Sing Out Magazine. This is a historical legacy, if you will. And Barbara Dane played a very important role in that documentation. Paradigm Records is, the Smithsonian, the Folkways Records collects record companies of community-based expressions and the like in music. And so it is at the Smithsonian Institution.
Yeah, I wrote the liner notes for
Yes, you did.
Dance of Struggle. And I think I was only able to write that because I was not at Howard University. I was a visiting professor down at Emory Henry College, and I had the time to really, you know, get into writing a long piece, and I'm very happy to do that.
You also wrote a piece for one of the important documents that people should look at, Bernie Says a Scholar, written in 1985, Black American Culture and Scholarship, Contemporary Issues. You have an article in there. I think this is the first time I published something that sort of foreshadowed my interest in cultural policy without having a clear framework at that point. Mm-hmm. But this is a part of her groundbreaking scholarship. And I just want to mention, you know, she did in 1970, curating before she came to Howard, she curated a program at the Smithsonian, Black Music Through the Languages of the New World. Again, this is before she started working on a PhD. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the Festival of American Folklife, which I said Gerald Davis was a major conceptualizer of, which explored contemporary and historical relations between Black American performance and cultural traditions, and those emanating from the African Caribbean and African Latin communities of the continent. This is where Bernice found her voice, and she documented this. She finds her voice as a scholar, as a historian. It was through that program that she got some clarity on where she was going to go. And of course, then later she finishes her PhD at Howard on music of the Black Freedom Movement.
You know, her voice was at my wedding back in September 1982. She sang at my wedding. But what was very interesting, you know, she also composed a song in honor of my daughter who was being blessed and baptized. And that's when I got a sense of Bernice as a songwriter. You know, what she had to do, she had to come over and spend time with me and Denise, like to get the vibe. Like I'm just not going to give you my voice. You know, I want to know who you are, you know. And is that the process? And I think in my lifetime, I don't know how it is with you, Jane, the two people who I really admire in terms of like the topical, you know, songwriter was Bernice Reagan and Gil Scott-Heron, you know?
Yes. They were both attuned to the nuance and the context in which they lived. And they were both voices that uplifted your spirit, but also brought a public education about power relationships and about the need to put forth one's own voice. And so that, you know, with Gil Scott, we could dance and shake our booties, but in our ears was going a really public political education and ideological.
I want to tell the audience, I do have a recording of you shaking you and your wife shaking your booties.
Well, in the tradition. And of course, when you would go to hear Bernice Reagan, and I'll use Sweet Honey and The Rock as the key example because my children, our adult children, and I, you would look around and see who were those people.
You mentioned like the hats of the kind, which is mentioned in, you know, Bernice and The Rock are wearing. Okay. I mean, to me, when they come out, they look like this is before the Black Panther movie.
Our community, like January Amosia.
Right.
Of course, and then January Amosia, you know, so and the creativity that is my speculation. The first major exhibit on Black hair braiding, in which Niani Kilkin about documenting that. So this is a part of Bernice's horizontal intersection with all dimensions of Black life, of women life,
Well, let's expand that because, you know, talking about Black women, road work and Sister Fire.
Well, Roadwork and Sister Fire, and this is where Amy Horowitz is really so pivotal, lifted by Bernice's creativity, and she worked with Sweet Honey and Rock over a number of years, but it was a collaboration between those two women who opened up a public space for women's voices in the public space, particularly lesbian women, but not exclusively lesbian women. Our children, our two boys, were very, very young. I think they were the first males to be in a children's recording with Sweet Honey and The Rock. So Amy is a central force in collaborating with Bernice and institutionalizing the kind of community-based work. And, you know, that's a thesis in and of mm-hmm. itself that pre or postdoc should mm-hmm. be looking at to do documentation on.
Well, another thing that needs to be documented, talk about the collaboration between Bernice Regan and June Jordan.
Yeah, well, you should talk about that. I mean, you introduced me to June Jordan and your relationship to June Jordan. Again, a singular kind of relationship, both in terms of your social bonding, but in terms of your creative poetic expressions. So you should.
Well, you know what? I was amazed about this. June sends her a letter. June sends her a letter saying, you know, and I've written a lot of letters. You know what I'm saying? You know, I want to send a letter to Smokey Robinson. When she said that, I'm like saying, what is she seeing that you sing this?
Well, I that's a great, what is that verb, seeing, that you mentioned. Bernice had an extraordinary capacity to see and to feel. I remember her saying, oh, this song was made up. I was on my way to a demonstration, driving in my car, and I composed this song. Mm-hmm. She had that unusual, extraordinary ability, which was always grounded in what has gone on with people fighting against slavery, what has gone on with women, what was happening in Soweto. Give your hands to struggle, you know, the Vietnam movement, the people of the world are finally taking a stand. Where will you, America, be next time? She was analytical. The song about the blouse that she took from the policy studies where she did a sabbatical. I have an email from John that documents that, how Bernice would come and talk to the staff. And then how she drew on that essay about the exploitation of women and the creativity of these beautiful blouses.
Let's talk about something that only you probably can bear witness, since Bernice is not here with us anymore. I'm looking at Regan. Interacts with some of these conservative institutions, whether it's how there has to be. But I know, being in some of these meetings, many people are sitting around.
You couldn't push back Bernice Regan, her very physical presence. And then when she opened her mouth, just the sound of her voice. I remember there was a controversy at the Smithsonian. They were renting, and it was put forth. Bernice spoke. The last time they took the drums from us was in 1619. It just changed the whole tenor, backed everybody up. She spoke with an authority, a validity. James Forman captures this, surety he uses to describe her singing and convening with the community. And so that wherever she went, it was going to be a break. To the credit of her professors, like Stephen, recognized that she was not just someone that she could learn something from them. She was someone that they could learn something, and that she would lead her. And captures that. He says, mm-hmm. it's some part of the resistance movement, but it was the voice of Bernice Regan who grounds that motivation force for that to become a national phenomenon, along with obviously the other creators of the snake.
Voice of authority, at least one, and you know him well. But that always associates that voice of authority with Harry Belafonte.
Yes, Harry Belafonte was asking if I would help to facilitate communication with Harry Belafonte, and I did. And then I ended up doing an interview. I thought that PFW was going to do it, but I called it Descent Towards Democracy. He was one of those who walked in the room and the descent.
Responsible for opening that ground for South Africa. I think him and Mary Makeba, I think, has that influence on Bernice.
Opened the ground for a lot of the musicians, major musicians.
Hugh Masekela.
He was the interlocutor for that. He took Sweet Honey and The Rock to Cuba. But back to Bernice, when Bernice came to Howard in the history department, she rearranged the whole university structure and her interdisciplinary work with the music department and the history department. She was taking three-hour courses. So Bernice was always a radicalizing force, but not able to tap into who was there and to organize people and to motivate people to move. really brought a paradigm shift into the Smithsonian Institution, and where the voices of ordinary people became her civil rights movement conference, where she had these scholars on stage with these activists, and the scholars had to, with those of the people who were activists who were not scholars, some who probably had not finished high school in the Museum of American History, because sitting in the audience were all these activists who would shout from the audience, no, that was not her uncle, it was her cousin, or whatever the dates or the issues were. And this may be the first sort of collective oral history documentation rather than just individualized history.
Okay.
Out of that congregational methodology that she brought from the church.
Okay. Let's bring in corner, I guess.
Let the church say amen.
Let the church say amen. Preach, sister.
So that says, thank Bernice Johnson Regan's life and activism. Bernice Presente. This has been, and you feel like me and Marjan and Anonymous and Janice, then go to the phones right now. Support that which supports you by calling 800-222-9739 or WPFWFM.
Thing of our show, I think you put on Facebook, Regan should be remembered.
Well, I was here before, I'm not leaving. Her presence is with us in her music, in her research documentation. And I would urge all of you out there to petition the public trust to come forth and do her work as a scholar, in which I, Amy Horwitz, really don't have to be participants. Many of the colleagues of the Smithsonian have taken to fully understand her presence, her still living with us.
Okay. Thank you, James Durley, who is the former Folk Life Center. Thank you very much. The station is WPFW 89.3 FM.
Hi, I'm Renee Bowser, a staunch trade unionist and host of a new WLife's community, airing Thursdays at 5 p.m. Workplace, the impact of unions, and how unionism can activate robust community among all of us. That's Unionism Drives Community, Thursdays at 5 p.m. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Every Thursday morning from 2 to by DJM presents a variety of jazz music, from free and spiritual to cool and smooth to groovy and funky. Thursday 2 to 5 a.m. WPFW.
The 20th anniversary of DC Jazz Fest happens August 28th. Bruce Joy, Jacob Collier, Stanley Clark, Emmett Cohen, Ron Coyles at dcjazzfest.org. Cast at a time.
Shalimar, War and Too Short. Come to Bethesda Theater in the month of August. More information at bethesdatheater.com.
Friends, we are back in August the 24th. WPFW will host the 15th annual Blues Festival featuring Clarence the Blues Man Turner, Jim Bennett with Jesse Terrell, Reggie Right Eye, and the Missing Pieces, all at Lamont's Entertainment Complex, 4400 Livingston Road in Indian Head, Maryland. For more information, go to eventbrite.com and search WPFW. We is building a better world, one broadcast at a time. Believe that.
From Rahsaan Roland, who has been your go-to since 1977. Your contributions have allowed us to uphold the mission of liberatory media set forth by our founders. August 11th through the 24th, WPFW, during our show, be made anytime at WPFWFM.org. WPFW, building a better world. WPFW, building a better world.